pleasure to have Lauren Attal visiting us from Syracuse University. Just a few words about her path. She got her PhD in Cardiff a few years back, then did a postdoc at the University of Milwaukee in Wisconsin, and then moved to Syracuse, and she's going to be telling us about the astrophysics and magnetism.
Thank you very much, Louise. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure today to talk to you about LIGO and some of the astrophysics that I'm interested at the moment and will be thinking about in the near future. Please feel free to interrupt me, ask me questions as we go along, or you can wait to the end. It's totally up to you. Okay, so start off with, what is LIGO? So LIGO stands for the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, and there's two installations located in Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana. Now, these two detectors are really twins in that they contain the same hardware. They're just assembled some 3,000 kilometers apart. However, despite them being twins, they really have very different personalities. Very much it's a product of the environment in which they've been installed. For instance, the Hanford detector is in the Washington desert. The ground is very quite different to the swamps of Louisiana. So that can have a real impact about the seismic couplings into the detector. Not to mention the weather is very vastly different between the two sites. There's a lot more storms coming in off the Gulf of Mexico and things like that that are affecting the Livingston detector compared to the Hanford detector. So these two detectors are based on a Michelson interferometer with 4 kilometer arms. And the insides of the interferometer are kind of made up, as you can see here on this image. This is obviously a bit simplified down, but I'll just kind of walk you through it. So the ground-based gravitational wave detectors employ laser light to be able to detect gravitational waves. We shine a laser to an optic called the beam splitter, an optic that perfectly splits the light in two. The light then travels up to 4 kilometer arms perpendicular to each other, bounces off these end mirrors, recombines at the optic, the beam splitter again, and then is read out as an electronic signal at the photodetector. So the gravitational wave detectors are made up in this manner to take advantage of the polarization of gravitational waves. If a gravitational wave happens to be going in or out of this board, for instance, so that directly on top, down onto the detector, for instance, what could potentially happen is that the gravitational waves will stretch and squeeze space-time so that the length of one arm will change relative to the other arm. So as laser light is directed towards the beam splitter and split into two, the laser light will then bounce up to the end test mass, say, on the Y arm. However, if a gravitational wave happens to come by in the time the laser light is bouncing backwards and forwards, the laser light will travel a slightly different distance. So what you'll see is accumulation of phase. So by the time that the light appears back at the beam splitter, what will happen is that the light will be slightly out of phase with one another, and that's read out as an electronic signal at the photodetector here at the end. So there's a lot of gizmos and gadgets in the LIGO detectors, obviously, to be able to detect gravitational waves. We're detecting a length change of some 10 to the minus 18 meters. So this is like 3 orders of magnitude smaller than the width of a proton. An exceptionally bonkers, if you like, kind of length change that we are detecting. And hopefully, I will be able to describe to you some of the detections we've made as we go through this, and so you'll actually believe we have achieved this feat and actually be able to measure 10 to the minus 18 meters, if not better than this. So we have the high-powered laser at the very beginning, and we have these test masses are some 40 kilograms in size, about the size of my head. And they're suspended on a 4-stage pendulum, as you can see here by this picture here on the right. The 7 stages of isolation that come into play to keep these test masses really very still, even when the ground is shaking. It's something like 10 orders of magnitude isolation by 10 hertz. So a lot of development has gone in to make sure that these test masses are not moving whatsoever. Two test masses in the arms themselves form a Fabry-Perot cavity. So this is meant to increase the amount of time the light in the arms interacts with the gravitational wave. The light bounces backwards and forwards some 300 times. So although the physical length is 4 kilometers, it's going to be something more like the 1,000 kilometers by the time the light is actually spent bouncing backwards and forwards. We also have some other optics in here that are highlighted. This power recycling mirror that comes just between the laser source and the beam splitter. That's there to direct light back into the interferometer that is reflected from the beam splitter. This is just to increase the power that's actually bouncing backwards and forwards in the arms. And the signal recycling mirror at the very end is to increase the bandwidth with which to extract the signal. There's a lot more things going on in here, obviously, that I'm not going to show you, otherwise I'd probably overwhelm the slide. In the top here, you can just see the vacuum isolation that you can see from the outside. In the middle there is the beam splitter, and on the two chambers next to the beam splitter are the two test masses that you can see here at the beginning of the arms, which are called the input test masses. So everything is kept under extreme vacuum. I don't think we've actually broke vacuum since before initial LIGO. We have various scenarios in place, such as, I'm going to unfortunately use the laser, such as these gate valve system here that are used to block off the arms so that you can actually open up a chamber without breaking the vacuum. It would take us something like 2 months to re-go back to vacuum if we actually ever broke it. So that would take us a long time to actually achieve anything.
The whole 4 kilometers vacuum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. The only thing that is not in vacuum is the laser source directly here, and then from about here onwards, everything is under extreme vacuum. This has to stop things like the laser light bouncing off dust particles, water vapor, various other scenarios. I can tell you some horror stories of how bugs have actually got into various parts of the interferometer and kind of has been zapped on the mirrors, which is not very fun. But yeah, the vacuum chamber in there is obviously supposed to help in some sense with them kind of things. So these are the two detectors really look very similar to this makeup that I'm showing you here. And this is our sensitivity. This is how we measure sensitivity. So on the x-axis here is the gravitational wave frequency, and on the y, the strain amplitude spectral density, which is really just the strength of the gravitational wave, how much you're stretching and squeezing the arms divided by the original length of the arms. So you've got to take 1,000. You've got to take 3 orders of magnitude off those numbers to get back to the meters that we're kind of measuring, the change of length we're measuring. So right now, the LIGO Livingston and Hanford detectors are depicted by these orange and blue curves. Everything above those curves is what we're sensitive to. You can see we're most sensitive around the 100 hertz, 200 hertz region. This is colloquially, internally known as the bucket. To the left of that, around frequencies lower than 1,000 hertz, is where we're limited by seismic isolation and suspensions. So if we can improve there, we can push that side of the noise curve down, and that's where the binary black holes live. Higher mass binary black holes terminate more quickly in the gravitational, the area with which the LIGO is sensitive to. So if you can push down the lower frequency, you're going to be able to see more binary black holes. The middle frequency range, where we're more sensitive, that's where the thermal noise is affecting us. So this is the thermal coatings of the mirrors. And by improving that in some extent, by distributing the the heat transferred from the photons to the mirrors around this thermal coating more evenly, you can reduce the noise here. And at the higher frequency end is the laser power. So it's the power with which we're going through the detector itself. The white curve above it shows you what we were looking like with initial LIGO. So this is back in 2010. We've obviously done a lot between 2010 to now. There's 5 years where we kind of ripped out the insides of LIGO and re-put in brand new hardware to obviously achieve this kind of order of magnitude better sensitivity. And something like over the next 3 to 4 years, yep, that's about the right time frame, 3 years really, we're going to be pushing down the noise curve of Livingston and Hanford to where the design curve will be. So we're looking at something like a factor of 2 better in sensitivity. So although we kind of show this as our noise curve sensitivity, we also talk about how sensitive we are to detecting binary neutron stars. So right now, this noise curve from Hanford and Livingston, we expect to be able to detect binary neutron stars to about 80 megaparsecs. With design, it's something going to be more like 200 megaparsecs. So we've got a little way to go, but there's a lot of things along the way. So with LIGO, we tend to split up with the sources we're going after into these kind of 4 areas, depending on the length of the signal that will be in our band versus whether we know what the signal looks like or not. So typically, the sources that we tend to go after, I guess, that we're more sensitive to is the compact binary mergers. We have a rough idea of obviously what the signal should look like from various groups doing post-Newtonian theory and things like that, giving us waveforms so we can actually look for those signals within the data. So these are compact object mergers consisting of neutron stars and black holes. And the short duration signal means that it kind of sweeps through our sensitivity region on the order of seconds to minutes. There's obviously way many other sources that you can go after, bursts such as supernovae or long gamma ray bursts, something like that, are some things that we might obviously be able to see with LIGO, but the amount of gravitational waves given off in these kind of systems is a bit more uncertain. We don't necessarily know what the shape of the gravitational wave is going to be in the detector, so it's a little harder to kind of bury deep in the noise to see if there's that signal present. There's obviously long-duration signals such as pulsars and the stochastic background, which we do search for, but this requires obviously taking years' worth of data, stacking on top of one another to see whether you can actually probe these regions. But for today, I'm really going to be talking about compact binary in spirals. So with that, I'm going to move immediately to the first detection. So on the 14th of September 2015, we saw something in both the Hanford and Livingston detectors in the wee hours of the morning. On the top here, on the very top panel, you can see the strain, so the strength of the gravitational wave in the detectors, and on the x-axis is time. What was really quite remarkable about this signal was the fact that you could really see it in the data with very minimal filtering. It was really quite astonishing for all of us. We were expecting to have to employ every statistical technique at our fingertips to be able to find that signal, and yet, just by staring at the data, you could see it. I guess a few of us took quite some convincing, really. We had to convince ourselves before we had to try and convince everybody else that we'd seen something. But yeah, this is the signal that we saw. I think it originally was first in Livingston, then 7 milliseconds later at Hanford. I guess the reason I'm talking about the time delay between the two is for a gravitational wave to be seen in both detectors, you need it to be within the light travel time of the two, which is 10 milliseconds. So 7 milliseconds between the two helps you also triangulate roughly where on the sky it came from. I'll talk more about localization a little later on. The second panel here is just showing you the same gravitational wave strength on the Y, but this time showing you fits to numerical relativity simulations. And it, as you can see, it fits really quite nicely. And when you subtract these simulations from the actual data, the residuals are really just fit really nicely with noise. So this signal, we think, is from two black holes merging, one of 29 and 36 solar masses in size. On the bottom here is a spectrogram showing you what the track of the signal might look like in the time frequency normalized amplitude plane. And really, because of the size of the system here, 36 and 29 solar masses in size, the signal appears for only a very quick, short time burst of energy in the region at which LIGO is sensitive to. So this is a really, really quite short signal. Next, we also found GW151226 on Boxing Day. This one was much more kind of what we were expecting to see. As you can see on the very top again, the strain and time on the X, the signal is buried much more within the noise there. You would not have had any idea it was there if you did not employ match filtering techniques. So with this, what we did is we took something like 250,000 templates, waveform templates, and brute forced looked for matches in the data with these waveform templates to see if any matched with the data. And obviously, we found something. As you can see on the second and third panel, you can see how the SNR time series accumulates throughout this kind of second the signal is in the LIGO sensitive region and where the peak in the signal to noise ratio time series actually comes from. We needed a lot of the in-spiral track here to actually make this detection. GW150914 was loud, but it was roughly at the same distance as this system as well. This system, though, is just a much smaller mass, 14 and 7 solar masses. So it was much weaker in the LIGO detectors. And on the bottom here, you can see the time frequency representation, which isn't so helpful until you actually subtract the time and actually re-put it back in. And then you can see quite happily that the signal is there. We also identified a third candidate event, LVT151012. From the date, you can get when it was. LVT, this poor trigger, LIGO Virgo trigger, was not significant enough for it to be given the GW name at the very beginning. So we saw something. We don't claim it necessarily as one of these, but everybody in LIGO will tell you that it was two black holes, 23 and 13 solar masses colliding as well. So we've seen pretty much three things so far. So from our detections, what can we actually tell you? So the first and the most importantly, I think, is that binary black holes exist and they emerge actually within the lifetime of the universe. We weren't too sure up until this point whether this would actually happen. And that black holes exist greater than 25 solar masses. Up until our detections, we'd only actually seen things, inferred masses of black holes in the X-ray, from X-ray studies. And these were all consistent with masses of GW151226, but GW150914 was much, much larger. So we think that the environment in which GW150914, the black holes that formed to create that signal, is very different from the others. It would have to be in a much lower metallicity environment so that the black holes of such size could actually exist. But right now, we can't tell you the difference between whether the black holes formed in a isolated binary evolution scenario or whether it was with rapid capture, dynamic capture. We just need more observations to be able to work out the formation channel along the way. With our observations as well, we've been able to test general relativity in the strong field regime. With GW151226, we could test post-Newtonian expansions in the in-spiral. With GW150914, because it was more sensitive around the merger ring down, we could test that part of the waveform. And when you combine these kind of results, there's absolutely zero evidence to doubt general relativity so far. Doesn't mean there's not other models that could potentially support this, but right now we can't rule out general relativity. And as well, we started to put constraints on the merger rate of binary black holes, as well as upper limits on neutron star black hole and neutron star mergers, since we haven't seen them just yet. So now I want to kind of change focus ever so slightly on this is what we've been seeing and kind of some of the things that I kind of worry about on a daily basis trying to make detections. So something I constantly worry about is the quality of the data coming out of the Hanford and Livingston detectors. And this can really change on a hourly timescale depending on the weather, the electronics. It could be absolutely anything that could all of a sudden change the state of the detector. And really what I'm most worried about are noise transients or glitches in the data, because noise transients or glitches in the data can actually mask or mimic a gravitational wave signal in the data. So it makes it a lot harder for search algorithms to actually distinguish signal from noise. So these kind of like time frequency representations here just show you one gravitational wave event and the rest are kind of some noise transients in the detector. Does anybody want to tell me which one's the gravitational wave signal?
Two.
Yay! Exactly. Exactly. But as you can see, there's a lot of other things kind of going on in the data that don't look too dissimilar from a binary black hole merger. So you've really got to be quite inventive in trying to either remove this data or trying to make your algorithm better at distinguishing what is noise and what is actually signal. So one way of mitigating noise is by correlating disturbances in what we call auxiliary channels to what's seen in the gravitational wave channel. So auxiliary channels might be microphones, they might be environmental sensors, they could be various photodetectors around the interferometer measuring certain what's happening in certain cavities in the interferometer. But what you're basically looking for is you're trying to identify times where there's noise in these channels, because if there's noise in these channels, they should not lead to an astrophysical signal. So if there's something seen in the seismometers and you see something at the same time in the gravitational wave channel, you can say, well, it was the seismometers, there was something happening here on Earth, it's not astrophysical. So we can play that game and try and actually subtract the noise from our data before our pipeline's even going to analyze them. So we try and remove the most egregious data by just like in this kind of systematic fashion. I can't simply look at the data and say, remove this time, Laura doesn't like it. As much as I would like to, that would make my life so much easier. I have to kind of find a very good systematic reason, an instrumental reason to actually remove the data. So just as an example here on this plot, you can see time on the X and amplitude on the Y. And you can just kind of, I think, get from this toy model kind of what I'm getting at. If you see kind of peaks in the microphone and there's something kind of going on in the gravitational wave channel at the same time, I can say, well, there's something happening in the microphones. I can model what's happening in the microphones and subtract it. If I know what the coupling between the microphone and the gravitational wave channel is, I can subtract that from the gravitational wave channel so it doesn't appear. Same with times of high wind. There's various different things I can do. I can just obviously simply look for a threshold in another channel and go, if it goes above this threshold, toss the data. So there's various kind of different scenarios in which you can play here. But unfortunately for me and other people, there's 200,000 monitors on every single gravitational wave detector. So actually trying to hunt down the actual cause, the instrumental cause, can be a little bit tricky. The channels witness a broad spectrum of different things going on, and there's various different coupling mechanisms that are going on, some linear, some not. It really, really just depends. On here on the left is just showing you the PEM sensor locations for LIGO Livingston. PEM stands for Physical Environmental Monitors. So these are just simply seismometers, microphones, accelerometers, things like that that are located around LIGO Livingston. There's obviously way more things going on, but that's just kind of show you a busy map of roughly where some sensors happen to be placed. But we constantly are monitoring the detectors on a daily basis in between science runs, various things, to obviously increase the sensitivity of the detectors as much as we can so we can increase the number of detections. And this is really important, and I'll just kind of show you kind of one particular scenario. So this is kind of one of the main detection plots that we kind of show everybody to say that, yes, believe us, we've seen signals to very high significance. On the x-axis here is the detection statistic, and on the y is the number of events. So we create a background to estimate our statistical significance based on time shifting the detector data. LIGO detectors cannot turn off gravitational wave signals from the universe. So you can't simply, if you like, point the telescope at a different part of the sky where there's not a gravitational wave, record the background, and then that's what your background is. That's impossible for us. So instead, what we do is we collect all the data from the Hanford and Livingston detectors. We look for events in the zero lag, if you like, in the foreground of our data. And then what we might do is shift the Hanford data relative to Livingston detector data by a timestamp just enough, and then look for coincidences again. So we're actually using our real background to create an artificial background of some million years worth of data. So the Rankine statistic of DW159914 was really quite large, much larger than anything we could see in the background, much larger than anything the detector could produce all on its own. Now, once we identify DW159914 as a real signal, we remove that data from the detectors. It's about a second's worth of data. We just simply remove it. We then reslide all of the data in Hanford and Livingston, and we come up with this purple curve here. And then we estimate the statistical significance of GW151226. So GW151226 has a detection statistic just larger than its background, so that is also a 5 sigma. Whereas you can see poor LVT151012 is really not that much more significant than the background, so it only gets a 1 in every 2 year kind of significance attached to it. But just to kind of emphasize the importance of data quality to you is when you look at the background of GW151226, when you don't do the kind of studies that I was just mentioning in terms of removing egregious data from the detectors, how significant would it actually have been? So on the x-axis again is your detection statistic value. I apologize, this plot isn't in the same format as the previous one. And on the y-axis is the number of events again. This data is actually looking over a smaller sample of data compared to the full one that I just saw you. So some of the numbers might not quite match up if you're looking extremely closely. But one thing to emphasize to you really is that the blue dashed line here shows you where the detection statistic value of GW151226 would be. And the red line here shows you where the background would go to if you left all of the bad data in from, like I said, bad weather conditions, scattering, various other things. And the gray line is what we actually did once we actually removed the detector, the background. So really what happens here is the false alarm rate of GW151226 increases drastically when you actually remove the bad detector data. As you should do, we found every single thing that we found an instrumental or an environmental cause. We had very good reason to remove the data. It was not simply to increase the significance of this event. Every single thing was documented. However, if we didn't do it, the false alarm rate of this event for the time period that I'm looking over very specifically would have been 1 in about 700-800 years, whereas when we actually do data quality studies correctly, it goes to about 1 in 200,000 years. So that's a massive difference to actually making a detection. So quite simply, doing data quality gives you more detections.
Sorry, quick question.
Yeah.
Can you go back? Sorry. What is that number of 10 to the 2 then? You said it's 1 in every 700 years or so. So, but then it seems that the red line intersects the blue line at 10 to the 2. So it says 100 events, basically.
Yes, yeah, so...
What is 100 then?
Sorry?
So I mean, that number of events,
yes,
which is 100,
mm-hmm,
if you don't do this cutting that you were mentioning. So what is that 100, basically?
What is this number here?
Well, I want to see how that number is related to the
I have to show you the false alarm rate curve, which unfortunately I haven't shown you.
Okay.
If I translate this from the number of events on the y-axis
to
the false alarm rate.
Events?
So this is just the, so with our analysis, if we actually do it over this time period, this is the number of events that we'll see at this detection statistic.
Okay.
So this is what the background would look like. So this is when you time shift the data in Hanford and Livingston relative to each other. Then you look at the foreground and then you kind of add one in here. So unfortunately, it doesn't really map very well to the false alarm rate, this plus at all.
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't. I've got the plot on my laptop.
Okay,
perhaps that's probably the one that I should have put in my presentation. But yeah,
are they linearly related to each other?
Sorry?
Are they linearly related to each other? In the sense that those two alarm rates that you show differ by a factor of a few hundred, but the curves differ by many orders, of much more.
Yeah,
at the point of the EW 1512.
Well, right now, for instance, this would be an upper limit. This would be the actual false alarm rate. This would be it's better than this because there's absolutely nothing louder than this signal right here. So the numbers might not quite add up quite rightly there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Laura, in this exercise, how much of data was thrown away?
About 2 days.
Out of?
50. Out of so we went from something like 52 days of coincident LIGO-Hanford data to about 50 days of coincident LIGO-Hanford data. So yeah, there was various problems. It wasn't all 2 days at one particular time. It was spread out throughout the run for various reasons. So yeah, this is just a plot showing you kind of the detections that we did make and roughly where they fall in the and where the tracks kind of fall in relation to the sensitivity of the gravity of the LIGO detectors. But really, just this plot here is just to emphasize to you that GW151226 would have been a marginal detection at best, might not have been claimed, and we would never have seen LVT151012. So yeah, data quality is there to increase the number of detections. GW150914 never needed data quality, it was so loud, but the probability is we're going to see a lot more things closer to detection that are actually going to be extremely loud. So more detections, more astrophysics, more of the interesting things that we actually want to go out there and do. This is just some of the kind of things that I have been thinking about. But in the next part of the seminar, I just do want to kind of touch on some things that I've been thinking about. One of them being, is there a mass gap in the black hole? Is there a gap in the mass in the black hole mass spectrum due to pair instability supernovae? Gravitational wave detections will be able to shed light on this potentially, and kind of what's electromagnetic counterparts would there be to a gravitational wave event and how we can go about actually trying to detect those as well. So what happens at the end of a massive star's life? Well, it really is dependent on the initial mass of the star as well as the metallicity. I think everybody can kind of pretty much quite happily be with the fact that at less than 25 solar masses, the star will undergo a supernova and collapse to a neutron star. But depending on the metallicity after that, it really depends. Most of the time, obviously, it will just go straight at initial masses of the star greater than 40, it will just directly collapse to a black hole. This is just a plot that I've taken from Heger et al. But really, this plot is here to emphasize to you that there is a region between about 140 and 260 solar masses of the initial star that there should be no black holes. And this is because of something called pair instability supernovae. So when you have stars that have these initial masses and obviously extremely low metallicities, there should be no remnant left over at the end when it collapses. Once we get to slightly higher masses again, the effect that I'm going to quickly discuss actually shouldn't be a factor anymore, and you will then be able to collapse to a black hole directly again. Well, there should be some region here where there should be black holes missing.
So is there anything on rotation in there? Like, is it maximally rotating or minimally rotating?
Yeah, there is a function of rotation in here. I don't think it can be rotating very much at all. From everything I've read, it's more the dominant to do with the metallicity and things like that. I should actually obviously quickly point out that the lower metallicity here is to... lower metallicity stars will have mass will not be lost due to winds, okay? So the higher the metallicity, the more mass loss you might have through stellar winds through the lifetime of the star, so that it will not be close to its initial mass by the time it actually gets towards the supernova kind of stage of its life cycle. So pair instability supernovae, what exactly are they? So the top line here just kind of shows you what you expect from an ordinary supernova. There's various stages of hydrostatic equilibrium, hydrogen fusing, hydrogen turning to helium, helium to carbon, blah, 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 all the way to iron, where eventually radiation pressure kind of fails to combat gravity. You have a supernova collapse. So you have a supernova explosion, and a black hole is the resulting remnant. However, if the star is sufficiently larger in mass, like I said, between about 140 to 260 solar masses, instead what happens is that the temperatures in the core will be extremely high, something like 10 to the 9 Kelvin. What happens at these extreme temperatures is that gamma rays will come together, creating electron-positron pairs, pair production, if you will. And in the creation of these electron-positron pairs, they will also annihilate losing energy in neutrino production. What this will cause is that the core will slightly contract. The energy is being lost in neutrino production rather than in just, you know, keeping the star combating gravity. As the core contracts, the temperature increases. And this is kind of a runaway effect that keeps going along here. As the temperature increases, more pair production, more energy, the core contracts, the temperatures increase, and this keeps going, keeps going, keeps going, keeps going, until eventually the temperatures in the core are so large that for some reason pair production shuts off. It just stops being produced, and at which point the star implodes. There's a rapid implosion of the core, which quickly ignites nuclear burning, and the star is completely disrupted. Thermonuclear explosion, the star just completely explodes, leaving behind no remnant. There's not enough time for a collapse to create a black hole. So what will happen is, with these original 140 to 260 solar masses, we expect there to be a mass spectrum, a gap in the mass spectrum between something 60 to 130 solar masses in the black holes. So we don't expect there to be black holes from this pair instability supernovae. This has been around since the 60s or something like that. Various papers, look for Hegger, Woosley, Fryer, various people describing this kind of theory.
Sorry, is that the gap in the mass of the initial star or the mass of the black hole?
So the initial mass of the star would have to be between 140 and 260, but this then translates to there being a mass gap in the black hole region between 60 to 130.
Zero metallicity, or does it matter?
Almost zero metallicity. It has to be almost zero metallicity. Otherwise, if it's a really, like say, close to solar metallicity, right, you'll get a black hole. This pair production will not occur. So the question is, can Advanced LIGO actually shed light on this apparent gap? Can we actually go in and see whether LIGO could actually tell us whether this gap exists or not? So what a student and I have been doing at Syracuse is we've been injecting gravitational waveforms from the merger of two black holes into LIGO-Virgo data that we expect to have at design sensitivity. And just these plots here are just showing you where the design sensitivity is. I showed you at the very beginning of the presentation, but it's this black line here for Virgo and the black line up there for LIGO, which we expect to be around the 2020-2021 era. Slightly different noise curves, that's just two slightly different detectors, that's all. So what we've been doing is that we have been making injections from, like I said, binary black hole mergers, scaling them in the source frame so that they have roughly the same coherent SNR in all three detectors, transforming them to the detector frame and injecting them into our data. We've then been using Bayesian inference and Markov chain Monte Carlo to recover the parameters, to estimate the parameters back in the detector frame, and then transferring them back into the source frame to see whether the kind of, if you will, the estimation on the masses and such are too large or just about the right amount to be able to see whether there would be something in this mass gap region. So just to give you some very specifics, I don't really know if this is if you're going to be super interested in this, but we've been using injections based on the effective one-body formalism. It's called SEOBNR-V4. The paper up here is just describing this slightly better formalism for two black holes colliding. I think it goes to 4 PN, better calibration to numerical relativity, And I think there's the scope of the waveform's validity is much better than it has been previously. So we can actually go to decent mass ratios between the black holes, etc. And there's been augmentations in the merger plunge, stuff that unfortunately I don't know a great deal about, but please see that paper if you're interested about the waveforms that we actually are using. But we're assuming non-precessing black holes and that they're and that there will be spinning. So as I mentioned, we scale them so the coherent signal to noise ratio between the three detectors is about 25. And then we sample uniformly in the kind of mass region around where the mass gap is in M1 and M2, so these are the mass of each black hole individually. Mass 1 is always larger than mass 2, just something that we do by design, and that we take the spins between, not all the way up to kind of the extremes, but this is where we know the SUB and RV4 model is definitely valid. So we've just kind of taken within this region. And we are, the unit, the priors that we're using to sample with are pretty much uniform over kind of the general space. We're sampling over the chirp mass and the mass ratio specifically. So we sample over the chirp mass and the mass ratio, but it's uniform in M1, M2. This is just so then we actually don't, we get enough kind of injections around the mass region that we're actually most interested in. And then uniform priors of the spins, the inclination angle, polarization angle, coalescence phase, right ascension and declination, and the declination is obviously something slightly different, and the distance as well. And we start the sampling at 10 hertz. Just as a kind of slightly different bit of background, currently we start everything at 20 hertz in LIGO. The noise is not especially great below 20 hertz, but by design we expect to be able to push that down to 10 hertz. And if you go down to 10 hertz, that means you can either look for higher mass black holes or you've got more cycles in the LIGO sensitivity region. So it really, it's the starting point can really affect your ability to actually go in and actually do some really interesting astrophysics. So just showing you some very preliminary plots here. There are still more things to do. We're just kind of getting these out and just checking some various things. So on the x-axis here is the injected chirp mass in the source frame, and on the y is the recovered chirp mass in the source frame. The diagonal line is obviously meant to be where they are, and as you can see, for much smaller chirp masses, we really do quite happily follow the line. Even the errors on the posteriors for these black holes are really, really quite small. But as we start going to the higher masses, we start running into kind of some problems, even with three detectors. At first, we saw this problem with two detectors, and we wondered if it was a function of the fact that the LIGO detectors are nearly co-aligned. So you're not having a really good estimate of the distance, which then obviously functions into what the redshift is, and then converting between the detector frame and the source frame. But this doesn't necessarily seem to be the issue. It just seems to be that as we start going to higher masses, there's less number of cycles in the LIGO sensitivity region, so it's a bit harder for us then to decide which waveform was actually injected.
Question.
Yeah.
So I cannot really see the colors. Which one of these are highest SNR and which are lowest SNR?
So we tried to scale them all so there would be about a median SNR of 25. So they should all be about 25, okay. But we've just kind of slapped a color bar on here. So they should all be greater than 20. There was a bit of variation, but they should all be about 12 at least in the LIGO detector. So what we would expect them to be at design sensitivity. We tried to keep everything as realistic as possible.
And you know everything that goes into this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you inject the template and then you look for it.
Yep.
So then if you think there is the discrepancy there, so what, I mean, you should be able to tell what the reason is, right? Or is it more than expected?
It was a little bit more than expected. I wasn't expecting it to be so bad, but these kind of templates are the ones where really you might have a cycle or maybe less that's actually sensitive to the gravitational wave band. So we're doing some more tests right now. So if instead we started sampling at, say, 5 hertz, whether that would actually improve this region or not, because you'll get more cycles. Unfortunately, right now, I just don't think the match filter is doing extremely well with distinguishing different waveform models at the really high masses. So really high masses, we will start running into problems, I think. But when we disentangle this from the chirp mass into individual masses, the dashed line here is just showing you where the pair instability region would leave a deficit of black holes. We can actually see that, at least for the mass one region, source here and injected and recovered here on the Y. You can still see, though, that the error regions here for some of these masses are still captured within the region, the black hole mass deficit. So once we start going to the higher region of where the black hole deficit might occur, let's say over about 100 or 110, we might have some problems about being able to say whether it's actually within the region or whether it's actually above it or not. But there are at least a decent number of injections that we perform that would be completely encapsulated by this region. So it kind of lends some hope that if there is black holes in this mass region, LIGO should be able to say definitively that they are within that region and not, you know, slightly under or slightly above. So it's looking like we can do it. It's obviously, like I said, more things to do in this, especially because when you look at the mass 2, things are looking a little bit rubbish. Again, the lower mass kind of region, we're doing really quite well, but it's the higher mass regions that we're really, really starting to struggle with. So a certain part of the parameter space, I think we would be able to distinguish quite nicely the fact that there was peri-instability supernova curving, say for mass 1 just into the peri-instability region and mass 2 well below it. Whereas if both of the black holes were in the peri-instability region, say both with masses around 100, 120, we might struggle to be able to say something with advanced LIGO. We're going to start testing this with future iterations of LIGO. So we've got things like Cosmic Voyager and various other things that are future iterations of LIGO that the collaboration anticipates will be in effect in the decades to come. So we will see whether this kind of thing improves. And obviously, we're going to dig into these simulations a little bit more. But these are just kind of showing you what I was thinking about fairly recently.
And so here, each event has been analyzed individually.
Yes.
So you haven't considered the possibility of stacking.
Yeah, we haven't considered stacking it yet, but that might be something that we might consider doing to see how many events we would have to be able to say something definitively or not. Yeah, all things we're thinking about right now.
So in the previous plot, there was a bias at the high masses. So
yes.
Do you understand where that comes from? Because it seems that perhaps the prior is still somewhat informative.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. We're playing around with a few different things like that. First off, it was just simply, they're just high masses. It's maybe the sampling, maybe got lower. Now we're kind of looking at the priors, changing them around to see if that will inform us better about what's happening. There's a few different things we're kind of trying out now. So, switching gears slightly, interesting astrophysics that we could do there with just LIGO itself, but what about if we had the electromagnetic as well? There's a plethora of really interesting things that we can actually really do if we have both the electromagnetic and the gravitational wave. So for instance, here on the left is just showing a plot that I've taken from Berger et al. So for instance, if we have matter in the mix, so if we have two neutron stars colliding or a neutron star black hole, what we expect to happen is that as these two objects collide, part of the material will be accelerated along the poles you will see a gamma ray burst emission. At the same time, as the material is colliding, current models kind of suggest that the material as it's colliding will undergo a rapid neutron capture, promoting the elements in the neutron merger mix to heavier unstable states, and then as they decay back down to stability, they will give off an electromagnetic emission, particularly something that we consider very highly to go after, the kilonova signal. So this would be an isotropic signal seen in the optical near infrared. And currently, the models, it depends on the opacity of the material, the neutron star equation of state, various other things. But we do expect a kilonova to peak in the optical near infrared on the order of about 5 days to about a week or something like that. So if it was we saw two neutron stars merging with the gravitational wave detectors, it would also be extremely valuable for electromagnetic partners to go off and see whether they can see something as well in the optical near infrared. It's very unlikely we'll ever be able to tell the GRB people to go after a GRB at a very specific part of time. The time scale is very, very short between the gravitational wave arriving and the gamma rays arriving, for instance. But in that sense, we could do an archival search with LIGO. The GRB astronomers could say, we've found a short gamma ray burst at this part of the sky. Can you look in your data to see if you saw something? So that's the other way around in which we can collaborate with the electromagnetic partners. But really, it's just kind of trying to emphasize to you just kind of the full picture which we can glean from both gravitational wave and the electromagnetic when neutron stars or neutron star black holes collide. One of the really exciting things, I think, at least from my point of view, is to pinpoint where the host galaxy is. Gravitational wave detectors are antennas. We're listening to gravitational waves coming from all parts of the sky. One gravitational wave detector, it's almost impossible to tell where in the sky it's come from. I say impossible, it's just going to be really, really large error region on the sky. Whereas if the electromagnetic partners saw it, they know exactly where it came from. And then we could pinpoint the host galaxy, understand what the environment in which the collision occurred, and work out formation scenarios and various kind of other things that are going on, which is super exciting. We might be able to definitively say that short gamma ray bursts are caused by compact object mergers. As well, gravitational waves are standard sirens. The amplitude of gravitational wave is inversely proportional to its distance, provided you know whether you know that the binary that collided is face on or face away, you've got to know its inclination. But this would then give you an independent way of measuring cosmological parameters such as the Hubble constant. So there's a various abundance of things that we could actually do with joint detections. And this slide here is just to try and give you a rough idea of the timescales at which we expect to see the difference between the gravitational wave and the electromagnetic counterpart. So as I mentioned, gamma ray bursts, seconds. But kilonova, it says days here, it's probably looking more like on the order of a week. But you've also got things like fast radio bursts that could potentially be there or may not be there. There's going to be many things that could be there or we just actually really don't know. So it's really important to point telescopes as quickly as possible. And again, I just keep mentioning these kind of scenarios. They're compact objects. There's obviously various other things going on, but they're kind of the things that we're targeting the most because that's what we're actually going to be detecting the most of. So kind of something that we did in initial LIGO, which is now carried over to advanced LIGO, is this project where we're trying to analyze data in extreme low latency, work out the significance of the event, and then tell electromagnetic partners if we have seen something. So here is just a diagram kind of depicting from the initial LIGO phase. This is circa 2010, but the principle really hasn't changed very much. So we take detector data from Hanford, Livingston, and Virgo. We combine all the data, look through it to see if we saw a gravitational wave signal with various different algorithms. They're just some of them listed. We then load all this to a central place, some central archive, and then then compute the sky map, decide its significance, and then we use people, such as me, to quickly vet whether it seems like a real gravitational wave signal or whether it's actually something instrumental and something noise-related and shouldn't be sent out. So right now, that's all taking about 30 minutes, which is far too long. We will eventually move to the mode of automating this to send this out completely to astronomers, and then we might end up retracting things. But right now, there's a human in the mix. Someone has to quickly assess the data quality, and right now, it's taking about 30 minutes. And so this bottom plot here is just showing you some of the telescopes that took part in 2010. You can see it's not a really great number. Some in the optical, X-ray, various things. But here's some of the partners that took part in taking images in response to GW-1509-14, for instance. As you can see, there's a lot more people involved this time around across various parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. This plot here is showing you the timeline of when people took images in around the time of GW-1509-14. You'll notice that some are actually before the trigger arrived. They just happened to be observing in the right region of the sky before we actually told anybody about it. And then these are kind of like some of the timescales for the rest of the partners. Well, really, I just wanted to kind of emphasize to you, there's a lot of people thinking about this and a lot of people getting involved to actually try and find something in response to a gravitational wave event. As I mentioned before, though, our localization is not great. You have to use time delays between the detectors to actually estimate where on the sky it actually came from. So right now we're limited. We have just Hanford and we have Livingston. So these are separated just by the US on 3,000 kilometers. So the time delay lends to quite a large arc on the sky from where it could have come from. The lighter the signal, though, the smaller the error region. So GW-1509-14 had an error region of some 200-300 square degrees, around that kind of number. For reference, the moon is a quarter of a square degree. Typical optical field of views are something like a few square degrees. So we're really orders of magnitude larger than what typical optical telescopes can actually be following up. And LV2 15/10^12 and GW15 12/26, they're more like several hundreds of square degrees going into the thousands. So we're really suffering right now in terms of localization. However, when the Virgo detector comes online, which is located in Pisa, Italy, we can then have another stream of time delays. We can then time delay between Hanford, Virgo, Virgo, Livingston, Livingston, Hanford. So we can form three rings on the sky, and where those intersect, that's where the gravitational wave region, error region would be. So this shrinks the region quite drastically. The more detectors we have, the more time delays you can perform. So it's really in our best interest to kind of build gravitational wave detectors across the world. There will be one in Japan coming online, I would say, in a couple of years' time, called Kagra, and also LIGO India is currently in the works of being built. So it might be a little time before that comes on, but at least later this year, Virgo will also be online.
Sorry, is it later this year? The O2, they are not joining O2?
Yes, they are. Sorry, they are joining O2. They're joining in about a month, okay. 2 months. That's the current plan. Yes. So, just to kind of show you just kind of like some sky localization regions with the Hanford, Livingston and Virgo detector around now. So the sensitivities are really quite comparable to right now to what we estimated in this in this study, sorry. So right now, less than 10% of signals are being localized to within 20 square degrees. There's various regions on the sky that we're really quite insensitive to. But we're expecting to see signals about every month. But right now, the error region is quite large. But focusing on these kind of ovals, they do start to really quite shrink when we start getting towards the design sensitivity region, where we expect to 20% of signals will be within 20 square degrees. That's just considering three detectors. Obviously, if we have more detectors, we'll be able to see even more closely. And here, we're expecting signals every day. So kind of some of the challenges that we have with electromagnetic telescopes is the exact same that we have with gravitational waves. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of things changing in the night at the same time. So for instance, I've just added something to the this image. And if you notice, I injected that into the image. So it's the exact same problem that you have. It's a lot of noisy data, but somehow you've got to try and correlate that that thing varying is statistically correlated to what we've seen in the gravitational wave in the gravitational wave detectors. So that's the challenge that's coming up now with the electromagnetic transients and how to make that statistical correlation between what they're seeing and what we're seeing.
Sort of at your detection, so how, in terms of optical brightness, what kind of magnitude would be looking at?
We need something like 23rd magnitude. You need to be getting down to about that to be able to detect kilonovae. Yeah, so this image here is 15. So you've got to get, like, you know, many orders of magnitudes. There's a lot more things that will be kind of going on in that image. And that's one thing that we're starting to think about trying to characterize. So for instance, this is just kind of something I worked on back in 2010 with an old optical telescope. So on the left here, you can see the image that was taken. On the right is a reference image that you might take months before the candidate image that you actually want was taken. And when you subtract the two, these are kind of the transients in the sky, but now you've got to try and say, okay, this transient here, this one very specifically, was due to the gravitational wave and nothing else. So that is the challenge. So one thing that I'm kind of looking at doing with some electromagnetic partners is background and injection studies, the same way that we kind of do them in the gravitational wave community. So by taking theoretical light curves of kilonovae, Jennifer Barnes is going to be putting together something that's going to be open source to this kind of type. So we can start injecting kind of the most up-to-date models into optical images and then augmenting them searches so that they can then really pull out those signals in the optical images and assign a statistical significance of how likely it is that this is a kilonova and it's associated with this gravitational wave event. So this is, like I said, just something that I did as part of my thesis way back when we were kind of initially thinking about all the steps that you would need to do to actually make a detection. But right now I'm starting to think about doing this with the Black Gem team. So this is a team that's spearheaded by Radboud University in the Netherlands. So they're building an optical near-infrared telescope at the European Space Observatory site in Chile. This will be capable of getting to 23rd magnitude in 5 minutes, and it is designed, this telescope, to go after the go after the electromagnetic signatures caused by compact object mergers. Its field of view is going to be really quite large. There's going to be 15 telescopes that each are about 2.7 square degrees. So combined, we'll get to something like 40 square degrees. So this is really going to be getting to the region at which you might need one or a few pointings to actually be able to cover the gravitational wave error region. And that's expected to be able to be operated later in the year. So starting to take some of the preliminary images and trying to actually augment their search, their current software to actually be able to pull out a kilonova signal when it does actually occur. So where are we right now in the grand scheme of kind of LIGO and things? So I've shown you various kind of plots here showing previously with where the sensitivity is going. But right now in 2017, we're in the second observing run. We're currently in about a range of, say, 80-90 megaparsecs there, more like really, where it's saying 60 to 100 megaparsec range. Virgo will be joining us in a month or two. And then we're going to go down for a year and then do various bits of hardware updates and start the third observing run, I would say, summer 2018, and then various upgrades before we actually get to the final observing run. So we've got a few more months yet. We're still currently debating within LIGO itself whether we're going to keep operating until the summer. We're thinking we're probably going to be on until August time. So it's quite a lot more kind of collection of data that we will be doing. So in the second observing run, that's starting on the 30th of November. Like I said, we're currently underway. We're probably going to keep going until around the August timeframe. We had a break over Christmas time. It says here that approximately 12 days of coincident data was collected up to the 23rd of January. The duty cycle was really quite terrible over that timeframe. The weather was shocking. But I'm not going to get in trouble for saying this. For up to about now, we've got about 30, 35 days of coincident data. So it's really, really improved recently. The weather's really allowed us to actually start taking data. So various kind of distances at which we can see various sources. So as I said, that we kind of, in low latency, we try and find gravitational wave signals, assess their statistical significance, and send them out to electromagnetic partners. So far, we have sent out two events in the second observing run. But just want to emphasize, this is a loose false alarm rate. It doesn't necessarily say that the collaboration believes their signals, but we have sent out two things to electromagnetic partners to follow up, so I'm allowed to tell you that. But we're currently evaluating all the things, and I'm afraid I can't tell you anything more about what's happening in the second observer run, other than the fact that we have sent out some things to electromagnetic partners.
Sorry, I have to ask.
Yes.
Was there already in the news maybe about a month ago, 3 weeks ago?
There was. I've missed something. If they have, I've been trying to avoid blog posts. More rumors?
It was in the LIGO webpage.
Yes, this will be it then.
So at least it was more than 2 weeks ago. It was in the LIGO webpage, and it was counting on 15-day chunks.
Yeah.
Is there any update on this?
It's probably going to be put on the LIGO website tomorrow, knowing my luck. I've just sent the recent numbers off to the collaboration for vetting. And then it's periodically, every month, if you look at the LIGO website, we're going to update these numbers and tell people about it and stuff like that. But this is just... I'm not allowed to say anything. You know I'm not. So this is just to give you a bit of a teaser about kind of what's currently happening in the second observing run. But we've obviously got a little bit longer before I'm allowed to tell you anything too exciting. But to end with, we're just finally opening up the gravitational wave spectrum. It's really quite exciting. LIGO's opening up the millisecond time frame of the signals. And really, there's a whole plethora of instruments that are going to be coming online soon to really start pushing various parts of this region and open up this region so we can actually start doing some really interesting astrophysics astronomy with the gravitational wave side of the universe. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
And the observed gravitational wave signal distinguished between two black holes with event horizons,
mm-hmm.
two dark objects with a high redshift, which do not have an exact event horizon. See if I can,
so we might not see black holes because we've seen something else?
Well, we have to, observation, we have to actually decide that event horizons exist.
Yeah. So I guess like everything that we have right now is saying that the most plausible thing is two black holes colliding at these distances. We have started to look into ring downs and whether they're actually part of the signal. In GW5914, I think you can see part of it. So that's kind of suggesting black hole rather than just dark object, right?
So clearly there are 60 solar mass black holes in the universe. In fact, you've observed one, right? The remnant in the
September. You've made,
event.
Yes.
But I guess you're looking for a system with where one of the progenitor masses is 60 solar masses or more.
Yes.
So suppose you find such a system.
Yes.
How do you know that that it's coming from a massive stellar evolution and not from a second generation merger?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, really good point. And that's something, again, that we're starting to try and worry about in terms of, like you said, making that disentanglement between the two. I think it's just, I guess it's more likely, I guess, that it's going to be two initial progenitors than, you know, think something's collided and then they've collided again. But I agree with you, it's something to think about, and I don't have a good question, a good answer for you just yet.
Yeah. Is there an argument for why there is X-ray evidence for lower mass black holes, but not for the 30 mass range, 30 solar mass range?
Oh yeah, I'm not an expert on that, I'm afraid. I guess it might be a slight observational effect. I don't know if anybody in the audience happens to know more about going after looking for black holes with X-rays. Yeah, I think it's just partly what we just happen to have found with the instruments we have available. They might be able to see more. They might be able to have seen those had they been more sensitive. Yeah, I'm not too sure. I guess that's just what we currently know with X-ray observations, with the X-ray studies, I'm afraid. Sorry. Yeah.
Question about?
So, when you guys match to waveforms that people calculate for the post-Newtonian expansion,
yes.
In principle, how many orders in the post-Newtonian expansion are you guys sensitive to?
That's a really good question. So right now, I know that we go up to 4, but I don't see any reason, I can't think of any reason why we can't go any further. Right now, those kind of waveforms are specifically used just to say we have found something in the data. And then what we'll then end up doing is use Bayesian inference to actually go in and find the correct parameters. We'll let the numerical relativity community know we think we've seen something like this, and they're let loose with the numerical relativity simulations and then come back to us to see if there's any discrepancy. And so far, nothing, but yeah, I'm not too sure if we could. I guess so.
Why did you include billions of years here in this last slide? Do you have something in mind for either the source or the detector for something that's billions of years?
Billions of years. So this is kind of showing you the this is Planck looking for B modes. So that's from like the early universe, so like inflation. So it's a completely different type of detector than LIGO.
I haven't followed. So how is Planck a detector for gravitational waves?
It can try and detect B modes in the cosmic microwave background. I think I've got that right, right? Yep. There was originally BICEP. Is it not BICEP? Is it BICEP that I've got right? Yep, I'm just trying to think of all the different detectors in my mind. Yeah, so BICEP originally said that they saw B modes in the cosmic microwave background, but they actually didn't turn out to be quite right because they didn't subtract, I think, was it the Planck background quite correctly or something like that for that part of the sky? Sorry?
The dust.
I forgot about it. The dust, that's right. I remember being at the meeting when that paper was actually released. It was very exciting. it's a potential that Planck could see B modes, I think. I don't think that's potentially, they just haven't seen anything yet.
I see.
Question. So going back to the spare instability.
Yes.
So you mentioned Kunayesh's question that it's very heavily dependent on metallicity.
Yes.
So suppose you go and then just you don't find the gap, but or you do, whichever way.
Yep.
You're gonna have to have a notion of what the metallicity is in the environment to be able to conclude there is a gap or there isn't.
Yep.
And if you don't have an electromagnetic counterpart, then how do you plan on getting that information?
Yeah, I think that's basically what we're going to conclude in the paper, that if, as long as you actually know the metallicity with kind of like, you know, that kind of side of things, then you will actually be able to see whether the gap exists or not. I think over time, obviously, as we start making detections, the distribution will be able to see whether things start to be avoiding such a region, but I agree that we won't be able to conclude one way or the other for the theorists, at least, until we actually see something else. But this is all at design sensitivity, by which point we should actually... that's a really good one, actually. because we don't really expect to see an electromagnetic counterparty in that region, but we could do, depending on the exotic model, depending on the nature of the system, if it had an accretion disk when it exploded.
But I guess you're assuming low metallicity, because I think that's the idea, high metallicity.
To get the sizes that
yeah,
you
they
do.
Would not form high mass stars in high metallicity clouds.
Yeah.
That's
so
it's
already
but,
given two projects,
yeah,
so this could be another one, right?
Yeah, this is another one to think about. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but high metallicity you can see right in a nearby universe. There's low metallicity you don't see in a nearby universe.
Right, but when I'm saying so, you get a waveform of black holes that are large,
sure.
But you really don't know where it came from. Because you don't have a counterpart.
So no, but if you have the amplitude and then you know.
Well, no, the redshift.
Yeah, you can get the redshift, right? But that's all.
And if it's happened to be around a redshift of two,
redshift?
Where the.
You don't know the redshift if you don't have. You have luminosity.
Yes, okay, sorry.
Well, if you know the cosmology, then.
Yeah.
Yeah, assuming the cosmology, you'll be able to tell if it's
so
in like.
You know. But we know the cosmology.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Now let's thank Laura again.
Thank you.